The blow had hit her forehead, but the damage had happened when her brain bounced off the back of her skull. Even 3 years later, Cheyenne still remembered snippets of what the doctors had said standing over her hospital bed. Her dad had sat by her and cried. Cheyenne had had a tube down her throat so she couldn't talk. There were more tubes in her nose and arms. She had kept her eyes closed and pretended to be asleep while they explained what the injuries were and what they meant. Occipital lobe injury. Damage to the visual cortex. Wiped out the vascular system in the back of the brain. What it meant was that all of Cheyenne's central vision, the 20/20 part, what most people thought of as seeing, was gone. Most of her peripheral vision was gone, too. She had been left with only one 10-degree slice on the very left edge of what had been her old field of vision. But the problem with peripheral vision was that it wasn't 20/20, but 20/200, legally blind. The way the edges of everyone's vision were, except they didn't know it. People saw with clarity only whatever they focused on, not what lay on the sides. So now what a normal person could see at 200 feet, Cheyenne could see a tiny slice of at 20 feet. What she was left with was a blurred sliver of color and shapes that usually was more distracting than helpful. Now, if she wanted to see anything at all, she had to turn her head away from it. It seemed like a metaphor, but Cheyenne didn't know for what. Paying attention to that slice of vision usually only gave Cheyenne a headache and didn't yield anything useful. A lot of times she just closed her eyes or wore dark glasses. For one thing, it made other people feel more comfortable. They didn't like to talk to someone who might or might not be looking directly at their eyes. The sound of her footsteps changed. The space had narrowed even further. A hall. It was colder here. She felt Griffin lean past her. A door creaked open. He nudged her forward. Once they were inside, Griffin put his hands on her shoulders and turned her around to face him.
"Sit down. There's a bed just behind you."
A bed. The thought made her nervous. Maybe it made Griffin nervous, too, because his voice was too loud, the way sighted people often were when they talked to her. "Can you untie my hands?" She stood with her shoulders curled over and made her voice weak and small. She wanted Griffin to see her like that. Cheyenne tried not to think about how she really was weak and small.
"No,"
he said in a tone that said there was no use arguing.
"Now sit down on the bed."
Cheyenne shuffled backward until she could feel the mattress against the backs of her knees. She sat. She heard him run out of the room, but before she could react, he was back. Until she felt him touch her ankle, she didn't know Griffin had crouched down next to her. She let out a little shriek that immediately shamed her.
"Sorry," he said. "I just have to tie you to the bed so you don't take off."
She felt a smooth, narrow cord go around one ankle.
"I'll leave you enough slack so that you can lie down."
His hands finished the knot and then tugged at it.
"Okay. Now, you're going to have to stay in here for a while. Don't even think of trying to get away. We're miles from nowhere. And even if you did manage to get out into the yard, Duke would swallow you whole for supper."
Duke, Cheyenne thought. Griffin and Duke and Roy, and doing something with electric saws out in the middle of nowhere. There can only be one place like this. "Please, mister," she said, "can I have a glass of water?"
"There."
Maybe calling Griffin Mister would make him think she didn't know his name. Cheyenne gave a little fake cough, but it quickly turned into a real one. She coughed and coughed until her lungs ached. She heard him leave again, then water running, his footsteps hurrying back.
"Here."
He put his hand on the back of her head and tried to tilt the glass to her lips. Most of it sloshed over her coat. Some of it ran down her neck. Cheyenne gulped, choked, sputtered. A little of it went down her throat, which felt as if it were on fire. Awkwardly, he patted her face with her scarf.
"You should lie down,"
he finally said. She heard him set the glass down.
"I'll be back later."
He closed the door. She listened for the sound of his footsteps disappearing down the hall. The front door opened and closed. As soon as it did, she rolled off the bed and began to search. With her leg tethered, she was only able to get a few feet from the bed, but Cheyenne used her free foot. She turned around and fluttered her fingers against anything she could reach with her hands tied behind her back, even bent forward from the waist and literally nosed around what she thought was a desk. She didn't know what she was searching for, and she didn't know that she would know even if she found it. Cheyenne needed something. Something that would tip the balance. She knew it was too much to hope for a pocket knife, a telephone, a pair of scissors. But even a pen would be good. She might be able to hide a pen and use it later to stab someone. The room was surprisingly neat and empty. Even though they didn't seem like the kind of people who would have a guest room, maybe that's what this was. The only useful item Cheyenne found was on top of the desk. She ran into it with her nose and nearly tipped it on its side. The glass! She hooked it with her chin and pulled it back to the edge of the desk. Then she turned around and grabbed it with the fingers of her bound hands. Whole, it was nothing. But broken? She pinched the top edge between the thumb and fingers of her right hand. Without giving herself time to think, she swung her hand in a short, sharp arc that ended when the glass hit the edge of the dresser. 8. This might change things. Walking back to the barn, Griffin thought that he had never had a girl in his room before, let alone on his bed. And it was weird to be able to look right at someone and know that they had no idea that you were looking at them. And you could stare as long as you wanted without ever worrying about being caught. Although if Cheyenne hadn't told him she was blind, Griffin might not have known. When he spoke, she seemed to look right at him. Maybe her right eye wandered a bit, that was all. She had beautiful eyes. So dark they looked all pupil. It was easier to think about her being blind than it was about what to do now. Griffin wished life was like one of the computers at his old school, that he could just make a few clicks and restore things to the way they had been 5 minutes before he spotted the keys dangling from the Escalade's ignition. Instead, he had made one impulsive decision after another, and now he was stuck with the results. Griffin lit the cigarette Cheyenne had made him take out of his mouth earlier. He could hear the radio playing from inside the barn. The sound floated on the crisp air. For some reason, TJ and Jimbo liked to listen to this right-wing radio talk show host, some guy who was constantly going off about illegals and HMOs and homos. Griffin thought it was kind of funny how they were always agreeing with him, saying, "Damn straight," when the radio host would probably have happily strung up the two of them himself. Iced over puddles cracked under his feet. It hadn't snowed yet, but it felt like it might. Griffin liked how the snow shook a white blanket over everything, softening all the edges. Take the remains of one car, a Honda that had been relieved of its wheels, door panels, seats, and stereo, sitting midway between the house and the barn. Covered in snow, it would become a beautiful, abstract sculpture. His dad had driven the Escalade into the barn and was now walking around it, eyeing it up and down. The SUV was cherry. It had less than 15,000 miles on it. Stealing it should have been a real coup. It would have shown his dad that Griffin was capable of playing in the big leagues. If Cheyenne hadn't been in the back. But that was a pretty big if. "Are you going to replace the VINs?" Griffin asked Roy. A VIN, vehicle identification number, was stamped in several places on all cars. Basically, it was a car's fingerprint. But you could take the VIN from a salvaged car and put it onto a stolen car. In essence, swapping the fingerprint of a wanted car for a legal one. Roy ran his thumb over his lip. "I don't know. It's probably too hot to risk it. I'm thinking maybe we should just slap some new plates on it for a bit and have you ditch it up in Washington, like the forest or something. You could throw that old moped in the back, and then when you got there, put the old plates back on and wipe the whole thing down and use the moped to get back. Leave it someplace that won't get found until next spring." "We could get $15,000 for it, easy," Griffin protested. We could get 15 years for it, easy.
There was an edge to Roy's voice.
In Oregon, there's minimum sentences for kidnapping and no plea bargaining. If anyone finds out we're involved, we'll be in deep for sure.
The anger returned as Griffin had known it would.
Just what in the hell do you think you're going to do with her?
They had been living on the wrong side of the law for a long time, but it had always been property crimes. Folks who lived around here maybe knew that Roy ran an odd little body shop, but they weren't the kind to ask questions about why it didn't advertise in the Yellow Pages, didn't have a sign out front, and didn't accept customers off the street.
Look, she can't even see us, Griffin said. So she can't say what we look like. She doesn't know our names. She has no idea where we are. We can keep the car and trade plates and VINs, and tonight I'll drive her out to the middle of nowhere and make her get out. By the time anybody finds her, I'll be long gone.
But Roy had stopped paying attention to Griffin. He was holding up one hand, his eyes narrowed down to slits as he listened to the radio. The announcer was saying,
"Coming up in the noon news, police are investigating the daring kidnapping of the 16-year-old daughter of Nike's president. She was taken at 10 this morning from the Woodlands Experience Shopping Center."
Nike's president, Griffin thought.
Nike had started out as a running shoe company, but now made clothes and shoes for every kind of sport, or for people who just liked the look of their clothes. Roy turned up the radio. In silence, the two of them listened to two commercials, one for a law firm, the other for Burgerville. The female announcer came back. She said breathlessly,
"Police say 16-year-old Cheyenne Wilder, daughter of Nike's president, Nick Wilder, was kidnapped shortly after 10 this morning at the Woodlands Experience Shopping Center. Her father spoke to reporters a few minutes ago."
A man's voice, strained but professional sounding, said,
"My daughter is blind. We lost her mother 3 years ago in the same accident that took Cheyenne's sight. And Cheyenne's also very ill. In fact, she was returning from the doctor's office when she was kidnapped. If she doesn't receive treatment immediately, she could die."
The announcer cut in.
"Police say Cheyenne and her stepmother stopped at the pharmacy to pick up a prescription. The stepmother, Danielle Wilder, went in alone to get it, and that's when the girl was taken. She is described as 5'2", 105 pounds, with brown eyes and long, dark, curly hair. She was last seen wearing a black tracksuit and a silver down coat. The car is a dark green Cadillac Escalade SUV, license number 396CVS. While there are reports of the car being driven at a high rate of speed out of the parking lot, witnesses were unable to give a good description of the person driving the car. An Amber Alert has been issued. If you spot the vehicle, police ask that you call 911.
The announcer took a breath.
"In other news..."
Roy turned down the radio. Griffin braced himself for the outburst he knew would come. The car was not just hot, it was on fire. And the girl was more a problem than ever. But Roy just looked thoughtful. He turned, spit a stream of tobacco juice, and wiped the back of his mouth with his hand.
"President of Nike, huh?"
Roy looked toward the house.
"We need to think about this a little more. This might change things."
9. Stealing a girl. The glass bounced off the edge of the dresser. It quivered in Cheyenne's fingers, but didn't break. With her hands tied, it was hard to put much strength behind what was basically just a flick of her wrist, and a little part of her was afraid of cutting herself. Cheyenne steeled herself and swung harder. With a ringing sound, the glass bounced off again, unscathed. She reminded herself that she had more to fear than getting cut. What these men might do to her was much, much worse. When next Cheyenne swung the glass, she pivoted with her hips and twisted her wrist as hard as she could. Time seemed to slow down. She felt the impact and then the cracks radiating out as the glass split and broke. Cheyenne was left holding one large piece, while several others pinged off the floor. Gingerly, she strained with the fingers of her free hand to explore the piece she still held. It was about 2 inches long and 1 inch wide. The edges were curved and very sharp. Even touching them lightly, she was afraid. It was like running her fingertip along a knife's edge, full of dangerous promise. Her heart was beating in her ears. What should she do first? The cord that tied her to the bed would be easier to cut, but she would still have her hands bound behind her. Cheyenne decided to concentrate on cutting the shoestring around her wrists. She gritted her teeth and twisted her hand until the edge of the glass rested on the shoelace. The position was almost impossible to maintain. The tension ran all the way up to her shoulder blades. Then she realized she needed to turn her hand even farther, or she would risk slicing her left wrist as well as the shoestring. She gritted her teeth, twisted her wrist, and began to saw. In her mind's eye, the shoestring was white. She had never asked anyone what color her shoestrings were, but white was the only color that made sense. Cheyenne knew that her shoes were light blue and that, before the accident at least, shoelaces had pretty much come in white, brown, or black, so it was probably white, and that was how she pictured it. Cheyenne still saw things, even things she had never laid eyes on before the accident. And it was more than just the little blurry slice of vision she had left. She didn't know what it was like for those who had been born blind, but for her, imagining that she could still see, as if she had simply closed her eyes and could open them to view the world at any time, helped her to create mental maps of rooms and buildings and even neighborhoods. And the maps made it easier for her to move around, whether it was in her room at home, where she really had seen most things before she lost her sight, or at her school or through downtown Portland, both places where her mental maps had to be built from a combination of imagination and memory. So in Cheyenne's mind, the shoelace was white. The bedpost she was tied to was painted brown, and the soft quilt on the bed was made up of alternating squares of white and pale yellow. And even if she twisted her head and concentrated, her sliver of vision might not be clear enough to confirm any of this. The doctors said it was good practice to hold on to her visual memory and to exercise her skills as long as she could. Because she had been born sighted, Cheyenne still related to the world the way a sighted person would. When she dreamed, she still saw colors and faces, furniture and flowers, and was shocked when she woke up and realized she couldn't see any of those things. And deep inside herself, Cheyenne cherished the hope that someday she would see again. Every few months, her dad would read her some story in the paper about experiments with computers or implants. Danielle didn't like that he read these stories to Cheyenne. She talked about raising false hope. But Cheyenne had long ago decided that she would rather have false hope than no hope at all. Sure, Cheyenne had learned how to travel with a cane, which was what the professional blind people called it. She had learned to use a computer that spoke to her. She had learned how to organize her clothes so they weren't inside out or clashing. She could cook, eat, put on makeup, do her nails, fix her hair. But it still couldn't take away the times when she said something about a person she thought wasn't in the room, only they were. Or the cashiers who saw Cheyenne put the clothes on the counter and open her wallet and still said to her friends Kenzie or Sadie, "Will she be paying by check or credit card?" As if she wasn't capable of speech. The room was cold, but Cheyenne's hands were sweating, making it hard to keep a good hold on the broken piece of glass. The tendons in her wrist ached. She ignored everything but the thought that soon she would have her hands free. A noise made her freeze. It sounded like a door swinging open at the far end of the house. Cheyenne recognized Griffin's voice and that of his dad. She had a few seconds, maybe less. With the side of her free foot, she tried to sweep the other shards of glass under the dresser. Straining her wrist until she felt like it might snap, she managed to slip the broken piece of glass into her coat pocket. By the time she heard the doorknob turn, Cheyenne was again sitting on the bed, sweat running cold down her back. In her mind's eye, she imagined several pieces of glass still lying in the middle of the floor, winking in the light, giving her away. Taking a deep, shuddering breath, she told herself there was nothing she could do about it now. The door swung open. Their first words were a surprise.
"Why didn't you tell me who you were?" demanded Griffin.
Cheyenne felt confused. Now that she was no longer concentrating so fiercely on cutting away her bonds, exhaustion and sickness crashed over her like a wave.
"I did tell you. I'm Cheyenne Wilder,"
Roy said.
"But you're the daughter of Nike's president."
"How do you know that?"
She spent most of her time trying to play it down. Even at the private school that she attended, where everyone's parents were doctors or lawyers, people acted like what her dad did was a big deal. All it meant was that he traveled a lot and that the whole family dressed in Nike. And Harley, Converse, and Cole Haan, clothes from head to toe. And sometimes she met famous athletes.
"There was a story about you on the radio," Griffin said. "Your dad said you were so sick that you could die. I just thought you had a cold or something."
Her dad.
Cheyenne's chest ached so bad. She didn't know if it was from the pneumonia or because she needed to cry. She wished she could hear her dad's voice, to hear one good thing on this awful day. Roy stepped closer. He smelled gross. She sniffed again. Peppermint chewing tobacco, like one of the kids on the football team chewed. The sharp smell of mint not masking the earthy, stomach-turning smell of tobacco.
"So how sick are you?"
Cheyenne was strangely torn. She wanted to act like everything was okay, to not show any weakness. But then she remembered what she had thought earlier when she was alone with Griffin. It was probably better to let them know that she was sick, because maybe they would watch her less closely, leave her alone more. They would think she was too weak to pose any danger.
"I've got pneumonia. That's why we were at the pharmacy, to get my antibiotic prescription filled."
"And your mom left you in the car," Griffin said.
Cheyenne shook her head. Suddenly, the distinction seemed important.
"Danielle's my stepmom. My real mom's dead. Danielle left the keys in the car in case I got cold."
She remembered how she had begged Danielle to leave the keys and pushed the thought away.
"Well, now we need her number and everyone else's," Roy demanded. "Cell phone numbers for your dad and stepmom, home number, work numbers. And we also need to know how much you think your daddy might part with."
He paused to let that sink in.
"Here's a tip. It had better be a lot."
Cheyenne had thought that Griffin had only been stealing a car.
But now it looked like he had been stealing a girl, too.
10. The etiquette of kidnapping.
Cheyenne looked frightened.
"Most of my phone numbers are programmed into my cell phone."
Her voice was ragged.
"It's voice activated. I just say who I want to call and it dials it for me."
"So was in the car?"
Roy turned toward the door.
"I threw it out the window."
Griffin hoped Roy wasn't going to get mad. It wasn't always easy to know what would set his dad off.
"It started ringing, and I was worried they could trace it, so I threw it in some bushes in a vacant lot near the shopping center." "Good point," Roy said, nodding.
Then he turned to Cheyenne.
"Just tell me all the numbers you remember."
"My home number is 503.
Hold on,
Roy said. Griffin saw that his dad didn't have a piece of paper or anything to write with. Roy went out and began scrabbling in the junk drawer in the kitchen, leaving Griffin alone with Cheyenne. She didn't look good, in Griffin's opinion. Her cheeks were red, but the rest of her face was blue-white, like skim milk. And then she started coughing again. Thick, wet coughs that sounded like something was tearing in her chest.
The cords stood out in her neck. Griffin turned to get her some more water, but the glass wasn't on the dresser where he thought he had left it. He went into the kitchen to get another one, leaving the room just as Roy came in with a pencil stub and a piece of torn paper. The kitchen looked the way it always did, but imagining what Cheyenne would think if she could see it made Griffin look at it differently. Dirty dishes were piled in the sink. On the stove, every burner held a pan with the remains of some kind of food stuck to the bottom. The counter was crowded with empty cans, open cereal boxes, tipped over beer bottles, and overflowing ashtrays. The only time anything got washed was if Griffin grew too disgusted to let it go on any longer. The problem with him being the one who occasionally cleaned up was that Roy expected it. There weren't any clean glasses in the cupboard, so Griffin picked up one that didn't look too dirty and rinsed it out before filling it with cold water. When he carried it back, Cheyenne was managing to choke out numbers that his dad was writing down. He waited for them to finish. After he had written the last number down, Roy walked out of the room and motioned for Griffin to follow. In the hall, Roy said in a low voice, "You'll need to stay here and watch her. I'm going to go make a deal for a cell phone that can't be traced, and then I'll make some calls."
"Can't I go with you?"
"Somebody needs to stay with her."
Roy jerked his chin in Cheyenne's direction. She seemed to be staring at them. Griffin wondered how much she could hear. Weren't your other senses supposed to get better when you were blind?
Roy walked back down the hall, and Griffin returned to his room. "I brought you more water."
She didn't answer him for a second. He heard the front door close and realized she had been waiting until they were alone.
"You're going to have to untie my hands so I can drink it myself."
It was eerie how her dark eyes seemed to be staring at him.
"Last time I almost drowned."
He wondered if it was a trick. But her ankle was tied to the bed, and she wouldn't be able to move more than a few feet in an unfamiliar house before he could tackle her. Then he remembered how she had fought him in the car.
"All right, but remember, I still have a gun. If you try anything, I'll shoot you."
The words were such a cliché that he worried he would laugh when he said them out loud, but instead, he sounded tough. He sounded real. He sounded scary. He kind of liked it. Griffin got out his penknife, his fingers brushing the knob of the cigarette lighter, and cut the shoelace around Cheyenne's wrists. She must have been twisting her hands because it felt frayed. She spent a few moments rubbing her wrists. At first, he thought she was exaggerating, but then he saw the red lines braceleting them. Griffin put the glass in her hands. She drank without stopping and held it back out.
"Can I have some more, please?"
He thought about saying no, then changed his mind. Instead, when he went out to the kitchen, he left the water running in the sink. Then he darted back on tiptoe to watch her. He had thought he would probably find her trying to untie her ankle, but instead she was still rubbing her wrists. Her expression looked beaten down, and unexpectedly he found himself disappointed. Griffin went back into the kitchen and finished refilling the glass. While she was drinking it, his stomach growled loud enough that she turned her head in his direction. He looked at the clock by the bed. It was nearly 1 o'clock.
"I'm going to make some lunch. Are you hungry?"
The oddness of the question struck him.
What was the etiquette for how to treat someone you had kidnapped?
Cheyenne shrugged. "I guess." Back in the kitchen, he looked through the fridge. There was a package of hot dogs that hadn't been opened. No buns in the cupboard, but they had bread. Every few minutes, he tiptoed back to look at Cheyenne, but each time, she hadn't moved.
11. Hope and Fear. Cheyenne put the can of Coke between her knees so she would know where it was. It was better than having to find it by running her hand over the table until she bumped it with the back of her fingers. After Griffin had untied her ankle, he had led her here, to what she assumed was the dining room, and then retied her ankle to a rung of the chair she now sat in. Given enough time, Cheyenne was sure she could untie herself. But when would she be given enough time?
Before they had been able to sit down at the table, Griffin had had to shove a lot of stuff aside, confirming what Cheyenne had already begun to believe about the house. People might live here, but this was a house, not a home. Nobody cared about it. Except for the room where Griffin had first taken her, everything seemed messy. Whenever he led her around, he had to jerk her to one side or the other, or he kicked things out of the way, swearing under his breath. In her right hand, she held a hot dog wrapped in a piece of bread. The hot dog had been boiled until the skin split. The bread hadn't even been toasted. It didn't matter much because she wasn't hungry. And it was easier to eat than something that required a knife and fork. No scraping her utensils across her plate, trying to figure out where the food was. She never liked eating with anyone besides Dad and Danielle. What if she splashed sauce on her top, or she was grinning away with something green wrapped around a tooth?
"When you eat, how do you know where the food is?" Griffin asked.
"My dad likes to tell me, like he's a fighter pilot. You know," she deepened her voice,
"the peas are at 11 o'clock, the meatloaf is at 2, and you've got mashed potatoes coming in at 7 o'clock.
Griffin laughed. For a second, Cheyenne forgot she wasn't talking to a friend like Sadie or Kenzie, but only for a second. She spoke around another bite of hot dog.
"He used to cut up my food for me because he was afraid I would choke. It was really embarrassing, especially if we were in public."
Secretly, Cheyenne always hoped people still took her for a sighted person. In restaurants or movie theaters, she would try to tuck her cane out of sight. Everyone told Cheyenne that she didn't look blind, that she looked normal. If she hid her cane, then people talked to her, not to whoever was with her. Everything changed if they figured out she was blind. She was tired of waiters who took everyone else's order and then said, "And what will she be having?" Griffin said,
"Even if someone tells you where everything is, it must be hard to find it on your plate."
"That's why I bring my lunch to school. Then I can just unwrap and eat one thing at a time, and since I made it, I know exactly what it is." Another reason Cheyenne brought her own lunch was that she didn't want anyone to have to carry her tray for her. People had to help her enough already without her asking for more. She didn't like to accept more than she could give back. She kept a mental tally of people who did favors for her, and she tried to keep the balance sheet even. If she helped Kenzie with an essay for English, then it was okay for Cheyenne to accept Kenzie's offer of a ride home.
"You know what?"
Griffin asked.
"The whole time you've been talking, I've been trying to eat with my eyes closed. It's harder than you would think."
Cheyenne resisted saying something sarcastic. Sometimes people did this, closed their eyes for a few seconds and imagined it gave them insights into what it was like to be her. Only at the end, they could still open their eyes and see. Instead, she said,
"You know what I miss? Like, if you have a baked potato and it has some cheese on top, but it all ended up melted on one spot. When I could see, I could move the cheese around, so I got some in every bite. Or if there was something I didn't like in a casserole, like green peppers, I could pick them out. Now I usually just eat whatever ends up on my fork, even if I don't like it very much."
Every word Cheyenne was saying was true. But it was also a mask, a lie to lull Griffin into relaxing around her. She had heard Roy's car start up and drive off. Since then, there had been quiet. No vehicle engines, no whining saws. Even the dog was no longer barking. Cheyenne thought it was just her and Griffin, in the house for sure. Maybe, if she was lucky, the rest of them were gone from the property, too. However many there were. She had heard four voices while she was in the car, too terrified to move. Griffin, his dad, and two other men. Of course, it was possible there were even more, but they just hadn't spoken. She hoped the vehicle that had been driven away as they were walking into the house meant the other two men had left, too. So she was pretty sure she and Griffin were alone. But how long would it be before one of the other three men came back? This might be her only chance. She popped the last bite of hot dog into her mouth. Trying to sound casual, she shifted the food into her cheek and mumbled,
"I have to go to the bathroom."
"All right, just a second. I have to untie you."
He knelt beside her. For a second, Cheyenne wondered if there was a knife on the table. Did she have the strength, emotional and physical, to bury it between his shoulder blades? Could she kill a person if her own life was on the line? And was her life on the line? Maybe these men would ask for ransom and then let her go. But wasn't it just as likely that they would take the money and never give her back? Griffin finished untying her ankle, then helped her to her feet and led her down the hall. He opened a door.
"The sink's to your right, the tub's on your left, and the toilet is all the way back on your right."
"I'm going to turn the water on in the sink a little bit," Cheyenne said, "just for some privacy." She emphasized the word privacy, hoping to embarrass him a little, hoping to push him farther away from the door. As Griffin closed the door behind Cheyenne, she put her hand on her side of the knob. Her fingers pushed in the lock button just as it closed. If Griffin heard it, he would think she just wanted to be sure she was alone, and she did. But not for what he was thinking. Even the lock wouldn't buy her much time, no more than a minute or two. But maybe a minute would be enough. Then Cheyenne walked straight back, hands outstretched, kicking her feet a little ahead of her so she wouldn't stumble over a dirty towel or the sink pedestal. On her left, her fingers brushed a plastic shower curtain. When she found the sink, she paused for a second to turn on the water. Not full blast, but enough to hide small noises. Griffin hadn't said anything about a window. But even before she reached it, she could feel the air change. When she touched it, the pane was cold. She could tell it was made of those honeycomb panels that blurred but did not entirely hide what was behind them. Was someone on the other side right now, seeing her hand, broken into pieces like a kaleidoscope? She turned her head, her left eye straining, but all she could see was the blurry starfish of her fingers. What was on the other side of this window? She traced its outlines, stopping when she found a divide in the middle at about eye level. And, her fingers told her, a lock shaped like a half moon. Something inside her loosened a tiny bit when she tried the lock and it swiveled. She had hoped for this and feared it in equal measures. In her head, Cheyenne reconstructed the twists and turns they had taken since leaving the car. It was a skill she had learned in the last 3 years. Before she had lost her sight, she could barely be counted on to remember left or right. After the accident, one of the first things the orientation and mobility instructor had taught Cheyenne was to always, always, always orient herself using cardinal directions. Now it was second nature, like a computer program running in the background, there when she needed to know whether she was facing east, west, south, or north. She had gotten out of the car and felt the sun at her back, so that had been east, because at that point the sun was still rising. They had walked more or less due west to the house. A bedroom was at the back of the house, so even farther west, and next to it was the bathroom in which she now stood. On the other side of this window there was... what? Not the men, not the power tools, not the driveway. That was all on the other side of the house. Probably no neighbors, or Griffin wouldn't have let her walk around outside with her hands tied behind her. The air ahead of them had been silent and still, no sounds, no smells except the scent of pine needles. Who knew if anyone was watching her now, or if a bush covered the window? Who knew that even if she managed to get out, she wouldn't immediately find an obstacle? That out-of-control dog, a barbed wire fence, or a man with fists, or even a gun. Who knew that Griffin wouldn't just break down the door, run to the window, and shoot her in the back? There was no time to think, no time to hesitate. Cheyenne took a deep breath and slid the window up, praying that Griffin wouldn't hear the faint rattle over the water gurgling down the sink's drain. At the base of her throat, she could feel her heart pounding. She fought back the urge to cough. She tucked the trail of cord into her sock so that it wouldn't catch on anything. Moving fast, Cheyenne put down the seat and lid on the toilet, climbed up, and braced her hands on the windowsill. 12. Running after a figment. Cheyenne had been in the bathroom for a long time. But Griffin didn't want to hover outside. He didn't want to look all pervy. Instead, he paced back and forth in the hall. Finally, he knocked softly on the door. No answer. He called her name and knocked louder. Only then did he think of the window in the back of the bathroom. Crap! He tried to turn the knob, but it was locked. Griffin remembered hearing the lock click into place, remembered thinking she was modest for running the water, and knew that he had been played for a fool. He slammed his shoulder into the door. The impact made his teeth clack together, but the door held firm. Bracing himself in the narrow hallway, he turned and kicked sideways at the door like a kung fu guy he had seen on a TV movie. He kicked it once, twice, and then on the third try, something snapped and the door swung open. A blast of cold air hit him in the face. So cold it was a wonder it hadn't seeped under the door and alerted him to what she had done. The bathroom window gaped open. He ran to it and looked out. Outside, everything was still. There wasn't even a breeze to ruffle the pine needles. The woods began about 20 feet from the house. He hadn't left her in the bathroom that long. Even in a worst-case scenario, even if Cheyenne had gone deep into the woods, he should still be able to hear her crashing through the underbrush. Instead, it was quiet. How could that be? But he had already noticed how sure-footed she was, placing each foot as carefully as a cat, drawing back whenever she felt something that wasn't quite right. Even if he couldn't see her, she couldn't have gotten very far. The quicker he went after her, the quicker he would catch her. His half-formed plan was to bring her back, tie her up again, and convince her not to say anything to Roy. If his dad found out, Roy would beat Griffin black and blue, and probably Cheyenne as well. And that was if Griffin found Cheyenne and brought her back. If he didn't find her, well, he didn't like to think about what would happen then. He had to hurry and find her before she hurt herself. It would be harder to keep the whole thing a secret if she came back all scratched up. A branch could catch her in the throat or poke her in the eye. She could sprain her ankle on the uneven ground. Right now, she must be moving as fast as she could through the woods, knowing that the only thing she had on her side was a little bit of time. Griffin felt a grudging respect. He stepped up on the toilet seat and grabbed the casement. He was just swinging his leg out when the faintest of sounds made him look toward the tub. Now that he was 2 feet off the ground, he could just see over the blue shower curtain with its faded green and yellow seahorses. And what he saw was Cheyenne crouched in the tub, hiding behind the shower curtain. Her hand was pressed to her mouth and her face was tilted up. Her eyes seemed to be looking right at him, and it was the oddest thing to see her expression not change when he looked back at her. She wasn't completely still. A fine tremble was washing over her body so that she almost looked as if she were vibrating. He could tell that she was listening with every fiber of her being, waiting for him to leap out the window and go running after a figment of his imagination. While she did what? Found a phone and locked herself in a room? Ran out the front door and tried to find the road, even hid in the house, figuring they would never look for her there? As he balanced, half in and half out of the window, staring at Cheyenne, Griffin heard the sound of two cars, one right after the other, cutting through the crystalline air. He identified them as the Honda and the pickup, which was almost as bad as if it had been Roy's Suburban. TJ and Jimbo were back. In a few minutes, the two men would be in the house, wanting to ogle Cheyenne, wanting to talk about what they had seen at the shopping mall, wanting to boast about their bravery in retrieving the Honda. In a single movement, Griffin pulled his leg back in and jumped, not out the window, but into the tub. With a sound like firecrackers, the shower curtain rings popped as the curtain ripped away under his weight. Underneath the damp, sour-smelling plastic, Cheyenne twisted frantically. He wrapped his arms around her muffled form. While he still could, before the engines cut out and the two men made their way into the house, he risked shouting at her. "Listen to me!" He shoved her back against the tiled wall. Her head made a hollow thunk. "Listen! In a minute, those guys will be in here, and if they know you are trying to escape, they'll tell Roy, and he'll make our lives a living hell." He gave her another shake for emphasis. "Both our lives! Do you want to get beat up and hogtied? Do you?" The shower curtain slid down from her face. Her lips were pulled back in a snarl. "I know your name. It's Griffin. And now I know for sure that your dad's name is Roy. When I tell the police that, they'll find you in a minute." He grabbed her upper arms hard, and he didn't slacken his grip even when Cheyenne cried out in pain. "Do you just want to die?" Griffin hissed. "Is that it? You start pointing stuff like that out to my dad, he's not going to feel like letting you go." Inside, he was shaking. Every second, it seemed like all the choices got worse and worse, and there was no way to undo what he had done. If only he had spent 2 seconds checking in the back seat. A 2-second mistake was going to destroy his life. Cheyenne was right, Griffin knew. If Roy let her go, the police would find them without too much trouble. And then what? Suddenly, she went slack.
"All right," she said, her voice low. "Help me get out of here, and then you can tie me back up. Quick."
He hustled her out of the bathroom, closing the door on the tattletale ripped shower curtain, and then back into his room. He pulled the cord that was tied around her ankle out of her sock and quickly looped it around the bedpost. What about her hands? He had cut off the shoelaces, and the remainder of the cord he had used to tie her ankle was out on the kitchen counter. Griffin had taken 2 steps to get it when he heard the front door open. He barely had time to turn back and hiss, "Quick, put your hands behind your back," before TJ and Jimbo were thumping down the hall.
"You should have seen it,"
Jimbo crowed. He had added a black down vest over his coat. Griffin wondered how he had been able to fit behind the steering wheel.
"That place was crawling with cops. And they had 2 of those portable news vans there with reporters doing stand-ups. One was that hot redhead on Channel 3. And they had yellow crime scene tape up around a bunch of parking spaces. Must have been where the Escalade was parked."
"Where's Re—" TJ started, then said, "Ow!" when Jimbo elbowed him.
"Why'd you do that?"
he protested.
"No names, dummy."
Jimbo nodded in Cheyenne's direction.
"No names, and she'll never know who we are."
It infuriated Griffin that Jimbo was capable of thinking further ahead than he had been.
"He's gone to make some phone calls,"
Griffin said. He risked a glance at Cheyenne. She was sitting with her back against the headboard, her arms tucked behind her as if they were still lashed together. Every time someone spoke, her head swiveled in that direction. He wondered if that was left over from being able to see, or if it helped her hear better.
"There was this other lady there, too, and people were lining up to interview her. Must have been your mama,"
Jimbo said to Cheyenne.
"Her stepmom,"
Griffin found himself correcting him.
"Did her real mom get herself traded in for a better model?"
TJ said.
"'Cause that Nike president's got himself a nice piece of ass." "Don't talk like that around her,"
Griffin said sharply. He could see how stiffly Cheyenne held herself. Jimbo and TJ responded at the same time with a mocking,
"Ooh." "How much money do you think he'll want to spend to get his own daughter back?"
Jimbo said.
"A million?"
Griffin heard the yearning in his voice. TJ reached out to finger Cheyenne's curls.
"A pretty thing like you ought to go for a lot."
Cheyenne's lips curled back. She jerked her head away from TJ. But when she did, she lost her balance and had to put out one hand to stop from tipping over. A hand that was obviously not tied to anything at all.
"Well, well, well. What have we here?" Jimbo said. "How come you don't ever tie it up?"
13. One way to describe stealing. Something dark loomed in the corner of Cheyenne's vision as the gross one taunted her. When she instinctively pulled back, her hand flew up, revealing that she was no longer tied up. She froze. What excuse would Griffin give? 5 minutes earlier, she had been ready to scratch his eyes out. Now he seemed like the only buffer between her and these men who treated her like she didn't have ears to hear what they said. Griffin sounded unhurried, unworried.
"She had to go to the bathroom. I was just getting ready to tie her back up when you guys came home."
"Are you sure that's all that's been happening?"
the gross guy said.
"I mean, maybe you're just taking advantage of the fact that you finally got a girl in your bed."
So this was Griffin's room, not a guest room. Cheyenne was surprised.